Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Now, I don't know about you, but when I think about the current state of ufology, I forgive me, but sometimes I think we get a little far out over our skis. In many cases, we've already decided what or who they are, why they're here, what their motives are, when they arrived, how their craft are powered, who else has this technology, who's in charge of keeping a lid on this secret, what the nature of the secret is, why there will or will not be official disclosure. My next guest is going to cut through all the smoke and mirrors regarding the UFO question, and he focuses in his new book, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, he focuses on the core questions, like what are UFOs, how long have they been around, and are they hoaxes, figments of the imagination, or real? But he also makes some straightforward recommendations to settle the UFO question once and for all. James T. Abbott brings his outsider's perspective to the UFO arena when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Following a short scholarship to Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, James T. Abbott completed a bachelor's degree in politics and economics at the University of York, England, and later researched a master's thesis at the University of Cambridge on global trade in the aerospace industry. His career has encompassed time in the aerospace sector, in marketing and education, and in commercial research. He's written and contributed to around a dozen academic books on political theory, business, and several editions on applied economics, and countless lengthy reports, including a good few on the aerospace industry. His greatest professional love is research, having the view that there aren't that many jobs in which one can get paid for having fun. But that's what research is like for him. Abbott is a member of the Market Research Society, the Chartered Institute for Human Resources, and the British Interplanetary Society, and lives with his wife in Yorkshire, England. He is the author of The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, Mystery and Science. James Abbott, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Good evening, Richard. Yes, I'm fine. Thank you.
And are you in Yorkshire tonight, this morning?
Yeah, we are, yes.
All right, let me ask you a totally unrelated question, but my ancestors are from Yorkshire. Do you know any Serretts in Yorkshire? Are there many? The butcher, the tailor?
Yeah, a friend of mine actually employs a girl called Laura Serrett.
Aha, well, say hello to my distant cousin.
I will.
I suppose. Second question, this is going to sound like a strange one, but I was so taken by the dedication in your book, for Miranda, the sort of human being who puts the rest of us to shame. Now I have to know who Miranda is.
She's my wife.
Ah, all right. Well, you know, if that's very high praise. So, if she's worthy of such praise, we should know a little bit about her.
So, yeah, she's a good girl.
The sort of human being who puts most of us, the rest of us, to shame. Wow. I'll put that on my tombstone, maybe.
Well, now, yeah, we all hope.
Yes. As a researcher, the aerospace industry, marketing, economics, is tackling UFOs a little bit like kissing the third rail in terms of research, as far as your colleagues are concerned? I don't mean to be flippant, but I mean, you know, it's a quagmire.
Yeah, it is. And I've been interested in it for a long, long time, and just as a sort of hobby. And my friends, my colleagues some of them are skeptical, and some of them actually are very supportive of the whole thing because they believe that there are questions that need to be answered. So I think, like with everybody with UFOs, there's an initial period of people rolling around the floor laughing, but after that they suddenly realize that it's actually quite a serious subject that needs some further research.
Well, let me get your overall view of the state of ufology, or the state of the study of UFOs and ETs. I mentioned off the top before the break that I sometimes feel that we're getting a little too far over our skis when it comes to this arena. How do you feel?
Yeah, I think it's gone on far too long in a rut, really. The whole thing is tied up with everything. I mean, as you mentioned, everything from the original sightings of UFOs through Roswell, right the way through to the modern conspiracy theories and the link-ups with abductions and so on. It's become so messy that there is no answer to it. So the people, there are two types of people, I think, that are in the game. One is the type of person who just loves a good conspiracy and a mystery and doesn't really care whether it gets solved or not, because half of the fun is actually dealing with that bit of it. And the other half are the people who look at it and think, well, what on earth is going on? And maybe we should get some real scientists in to work out what's going on.
Well, there's the rub. A genuine scientific study, academic study from some sort of an authority, a government authority perhaps, with no agenda, because that has obviously been the criticism, is that, yes, we have studies. They always seem to come to this conclusion. Nothing to see here, folks. Go on home to your kids. There's an agenda there. Has there been, to your mind, though, maybe outside of the United States, maybe in England, maybe in France, a government-sponsored scientific study that has come at least the closest to being genuine, to being without agenda?
No, I don't think there has ever been a government study that has been conducted without an agenda, because governments run scared of the subject. They really don't understand it themselves, and so they try to avoid it. At first, of course, back in the States in the 1940s, they threw fun at it, you know, laughed at it, told people they were silly, seeing things in the sky, and so on. And they did in England too. In fact, one of our most famous test pilots got ridiculed because he saw a UFO, and the net effect of all of this is to cast a cloud over the whole subject, what it means is that the minute the subject comes up over a dinner table, you say, yes, I'm interested in UFOs. I think they're quite an interesting subject, and everybody smirks. So, you know, that's the problem, and I think governments have been responsible for most of that ridicule. And understandably, in many ways, because the poor things actually do, they have feelings. They hate being wrong, and they hate not being able to answer citizens' questions when they phone up and say, I've seen something in the sky, I don't know what it is, could you tell me, please? And governments hate not being able to answer.
All right, so outside of government, then, a non-governmental scientific agency that would adhere to the scientific method.
Yeah.
Where are they?
Well, they're struggling, because what they're doing at the moment is, I mean, there are a number of them. There are outfits in France. There's one called UFO Science, and there are outfits in the state. New Fork is doing some good work. NARCAP, I think, does excellent work on the things that it's able to research. And there are a number of areas where people are trying to develop instruments. I mean, I know this sounds really silly, you know, trying to locate UFOs. It's a task which I think is going to prove well beyond private organizations, no matter how well funded they are. And MUFON is probably the best funded organization in the world for this sort of thing. But they, I think, there's just not enough money. We need to have a lot of money and a lot of research, because I think that whatever is behind these phenomena is going to take a long, long time to sort out.
I want to jump ahead to Chapter 7, and at some point we'll circle back and talk about photographic and video evidence.
Yeah.
But Chapter 7 is Seeing Believing, and you're right here, where evidence of UFOs is concerned, we as human beings adopt a strange and almost unique philosophical position. You've sort of hinted at that. We talk about, you know, the smirks going around the dinner table. But how would you characterize this unique philosophical position when it comes to UFOs, the evidence for UFOs?
Well, the evidence for UFOs is unique because nobody believes it, not a single person. You could, if somebody came up with tens of thousands of photographs of the Loch Ness Monster, people would start to take notice. I mean, the government over here back in the 60s took notice when one photograph was taken, apparently, and nobody knows whether it was real or not, even to this day. But the point is, one photograph instigated a government inquiry and sent teams of scientists up to Loch Ness to actually try and find this monster. Now, We have tens of thousands, and I think that's a conservative estimate, of photographs on the web and on in people's computers and cameras around the world, and not one of them is ever believed, apparently, by government. They turn a blind eye to it, and other people do too. The first instinct is to say, yeah, that's a blob of light, or yes, that could have been a shadow, or that's something on the window, or maybe it was an insect or whatever. And it could have been any of those things. But the word could comes up in ufology all the time. People use that word and they say, it could have been this, it could have been that, it could have been another thing. Nobody ever says, look, I know what it was because I can prove what it was in a replicable way. And that's the same with Chapter 7, as you say. It's the photographs of UFOs that are really compelling. I mean, the Trent photograph back in the 1950s, right the way through to the Canadian one in 1981, Hannah McRoberts. But the standard response to all of them is it couldn't have been a UFO. I always remember that policeman's response back in, I think it was during the Phoenix sightings in the 80s, where somebody rang the police station and said, I've seen a UFO, and the policeman said it couldn't have been a UFO. And the person said, why couldn't it have been a UFO? He said, because UFOs don't exist.
I love the circular arguments, exactly.
Yeah.
What is that psychologically? Is that normalcy bias that's at play?
Yeah, I think it is. It's biased towards what we know and what we trust and what we're comfortable with. UFOs are well outside the comfort zone for everybody. And the more I've looked into the subject, the more it's obvious that that's behind a lot of the ridicule. It's exactly the sort of thing when people talk about ghosts at a dinner party. So you're sitting at a dinner party, it's approaching midnight, and people have had a lovely dinner, and they've had quite a bit of wine, and they've really enjoyed themselves. And somebody comes up with a ghost story and says, you know, I saw a ghost once. The first instinct around the table is to smile and to say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, good for you. But after that, people start to listen. And I think that's the problem with the UFO thing, that people laugh first and then think second.
And how do we get around that? Do you have any recommendations?
I think it's like all things with humanity. We are creatures of habit. And if we've got into the habit of believing something, then we will naturally carry on with that as long as it gives us comfort. We love things that we know, and we hate things that we don't know. So I've got a story in the book about rocks from space, which, you know, it's an old story because we now know them as meteors and meteorites. But for a long, long time, for hundreds and hundreds of years, the scientific establishment said they couldn't possibly exist. And they were right. I mean, logically and scientifically, these things could not exist. I mean, how on earth do big, huge rocks get up into the sky to fall back to the earth? So they were saying, you know, that's one problem. But then there's another problem, because people say they burn. Now, who on earth believes that rocks burn? Because we use them beside a campfire. We put them around a campfire to stop other things burning. So, you know, how do they? And it took 300 years for the scientific establishment to even begin. And that included about 50 years of ridicule of the guy who first said, actually, these things do exist.
You know, we tend to believe we're making inroads. You know, witness the reporting at the New York Times back in December, and people think, oh, we're getting close. But at the government level, really nothing has really changed since what? The Grudge Report, I suppose.
Yeah, I think governments always end up every single report and say, these things are of no defense significance, so we're not going to study them ever again. And then 20, 30 years later, they start studying them again because somebody in government says, look, hang on, there is something here. There is something going on. So there was Grudge, and then there was, you know, the Robertson report, and then there was Condyne, and the Condyne report in Britain was one of the most detailed reports ever done into UFOs. But we now know, because of recent releases and recent memos that have been released, that it was a setup. It was designed by the government to get off the UFO hook, because UFOs were costing far too much money. People were actually wanting their sightings recorded and analyzed, and they wanted answers, like all people do. So the government said, okay, we'll set up a review, and if it turns out that the UFOs could have been something else, then we'll cancel the whole UFO thing. So in Britain, the Condine report ran in the late 90s up to the year 2000. They issued a report which was 400 pages long, and which goes in incredible detail into the scientific possibilities behind UFOs. But it is what I call a could report, because every single paragraph virtually says it could have been ball lightning, it could have been plasma, it could have been a star. Now, you know, those are all right. So the Condine report was issued, and the government said, right, we're not going to study UFOs ever again. But they kept the UFO desk open at the Ministry of Defense for another 9 years. And it was only when the numbers of people phoning that desk became absolutely unmanageable economically that they closed the desk and closed government apparent interest in UFOs.
I want to just crawl inside the head of the skeptic for a moment, which you have done in Chapter 8. There are no such things as UFOs. And you talk about Philip J. Klass. Let's start off by explaining who he was, and then you call it the Klass process of mass delusion. Let's walk us through that, if you would, as well.
Yeah, sure. Philip Klass was a very interesting chap. He was very accomplished, was a journalist, an author. He worked for Aviation Week, what's now called Aviation Week and Space Technology, for a very long time. And he was highly respected in aerospace circles. But he was a UFO skeptic. He believed that UFOs did not exist and that people were effectively deluding themselves. He believed in a process of mass delusion, which went like this. First of all, someone would think they saw something in the sky, and they would excitedly phone the local newspaper. In those days, it would be the local newspaper, or the radio station, of course. And they would, and they'd say, "Look, I've seen something in the sky." The local newspaper or radio station, of course, wanting something a little bit unusual to put on the air or on their front pages, thought, "Great, this is a good story. We'll run it." So first thing the next morning, runs a headline saying, "UFOs exist. Man sees UFO over whatever." Now, that's the first stage. The second stage in Philip Klass's book is that then everybody else starts to see UFOs, because everybody else thinks, wow, there must be UFOs up there, so I'll go out tonight and I'll see some. And they do, and they report them. So what you then have is what ufologists call a wave of UFOs. Suddenly UFOs are being seen all over the place. And this carries on. People persuade each other mentally that these things are real, that they exist, and anything they see in the sky from that point on is a UFO. It has to be a UFO. And that carries on. This process of mass delusion, as Philip Klass calls it, carries on until, in his view, the newspapers get tired of it. And the newspapers say, yeah, we're not taking any more stories about UFOs, and we'll all go home and we'll get on to the next thing, which is, I don't know, crop circles or ghosts or whatever. So Philip Klass sincerely believed that that was behind the whole thing. And when it wasn't behind what was going on, it was generally natural things that were being seen in the sky. His favorite was plasma, because it couldn't be explained in those days, and it couldn't be seen very often. But he thought that lights in the sky would be something called plasma, or ball lightning, of course. That was another favorite. So Klass was an interesting character. He had this saying, you know, about UFOs. He said, it's a really weird subject, isn't it? Because the UFOs are generally lit. There are lights on them. And everybody, virtually everybody who sees a UFO, either reports it as a light in the sky or as an object with lights on. And there's some very detailed explanations of what that means.
James, I'm going to get you to hold on to that thought just a moment. We'll be back and we'll continue to talk about the Klass process of mass delusion and much more. The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. Here's Gene Knight taking us into the break with Dirt on Coast to Coast AM. There's a Harvard startup company. They've begun preliminary experiments on beagles. And James Abbott in Yorkshire, not the the beagle that walks the beat. I'm talking about dogs. And anyway, this Harvard startup company claims it can make animals younger by adding new DNA instructions to their bodies. And the co-founder says they've experimented on mice, and now they hope to bring it to humans. And the lab is testing more than 60 different gene therapies to reverse aging in dogs. They want you to live to 130 in the body of a 22-year-old. That sounds pretty good, at least on the surface. Back with more of my conversation with researcher James Abbott and The Outsider's Guide to UFOs when Coast to Coast AM continues. We are back with James Abbott, the author of The Outsider's Guide to UFOs, Volume 1, Mystery and Science. And this guy just loves research. We're trying to understand the skeptics right now. And we were talking earlier, James, about Philip J. Klass, this journalist who covered aviation. And he had developed this, I guess we call it the Klass process of mass delusion. And you were sort of going down or itemizing that for us before the break. We had a couple more on that list to go, I think, didn't we?
On the process? Well, yes. In terms of the process is wrong. I really don't think you can say that people get hysterical about UFOs and they see the things in the sky, then the newspapers print it, then more people see it, and so on and so forth until the newspapers get tired of it. My approach to that is to say, well, it could work exactly the opposite way. It could be that people see UFOs, and yes, other people see UFOs, but then there's a dampening effect on that. It's not something which is self-sustaining, because people ridicule other people seeing UFOs. They actually don't want to see them. And if you look online at any of the decent UFO sites and read the accounts, most people aren't saying, "I saw a UFO, please send me my tinfoil hat." What they say is, "I saw something in the sky. I don't know what it is. Please explain it to me." Now, right. that is entirely different. And Philip Klass, I think, exaggerated the hysterical side of things.
And I think you also nailed it with sort of deconstructing the Klass's mass delusion process with number three, which is natural laziness.
Yeah. I mean, people don't want to report UFOs. They don't rush to their phones necessarily. I think what we have to remember is that 99% of the people, probably even more than that, of the people who see UFOs are genuine, decent people. They are not the people who are running around with their hands in the air and tinfoil hats on. They're people who are going about their everyday lives. They're mothers in cars with their children. They're husbands going to work. They're people, teenagers out fishing or something. It's not a geek hobby. It's something that people do not understand, and therefore they do tend to say, "No, I'm not going to report this." And then there is, as I say, the natural laziness thing, which is, you know, you look at each other and you say, "You know, are you going to report that?" "No, I'm not going to report it. Somebody else will do that. We'll go to bed."
You do. I wouldn't necessarily say cede some ground to Klass, but I guess you point out that he makes a reasonable point in a piece that he wrote for the Washington Post. And Klass writes, "If there are UFOs and they want to make themselves known, land. And if they don't want to make their visits known, turn off the lights." And as you say, this really hits the core of the UFO conundrum. Why are there so many sightings and why are they so visible? Good questions.
Yeah, I mean, I've got great respect for Philip Klass. I think at times he could be a bit brutal and not such a nice person. But he made some very, very good points about UFOs. This thing about their visibility is a real problem. Why do people see them? I mean, the Washington sightings back in the 1950s were spectacular. Then we had the Hudson Valley sightings, when literally scores of UFOs were seen by thousands of people, and we have no explanation for them because the government hadn't got an investigative body then. But why do they have all these lights? Why do they do these things? That's a real problem. And nobody can answer that. Not at the moment.
No. Instead, we sort of impose our own suppositions. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, for many of us, we've already decided who they are, what they are, where they come from, and why they're here. But sometimes we need to go back to square one and start asking the basic questions. Continuing on with sort of the skeptical line of inquiry, and that is, and you detail some 20 explanations that skeptics often use for UFOs. And let's be honest, in many cases, we can explain the vast majority of sightings with one of these 20. It's that 2 or 3% that we can't explain that we really need to concern ourselves with. But one of these really jumped out at me, and it's under the category of light aberrations, and I've never heard of this before. It's something called a sun dog. What is a sun dog?
A sun dog is very simple. We all see them from time to time. It takes quite special meteorological conditions, but when there are ice crystals in clouds, you actually don't notice it, but you can see the sun. And then to one side, either side of the sun, usually in line with the horizon, will be another light, and there'll be two lights generally. But sometimes people only see one of what are called these sun dogs. Basically, it's sunlight being reflected from ice crystals in the cloud in a different direction to the sun itself. So you see it and you think, wow, that's another light. Because the other sun dog, the one that's on the other side, which would naturally be seen, is probably clouded, you know, shielded by another cloud. Sun dogs are particularly fooling for most people. They don't understand them, and there are lots and lots of things like that that people don't understand. But at least they're honest enough to say, "I don't understand what I saw."
The other one, and I believe the mainstream media used this to explain the Chicago O'Hare UFO incident, yeah. And that is a lenticular cloud, a lenticular cloud. What is a lenticular cloud?
Yeah, actually, they didn't use that at O'Hare. That was a hole punch cloud.
Ah,
but a lenticular cloud is a circular cloud, again formed by specific meteorological conditions. And it, with the sun on it in certain lights, it can look exactly like a disc-shaped UFO. My problem with lenticular clouds is that they are very, very specific and very large. And you'd have a job seeing one and thinking, well, that's a UFO really in real life.
And you mentioned, was it the hole punch cloud?
Yeah, a hole punch cloud.
That's very rare, isn't it?
Yeah, extremely rare. Again, that's caused by ice crystals falling through the cloud and clearing away all the moisture in the cloud, all the condensation, and leaving a hole. And there are such things. It actually happens on occasion. But again, the meteorological conditions have to be very, very precise. And the people who've looked into the Chicago O'Hare sighting say that wasn't the case. It couldn't have been one of those.
And then we have this category of new atmospheric phenomena. Apparently, we're creating new atmospheric conditions. But some interesting things here: blue sprites, charge fields, buoyant masses of plasma.
Yeah, it's fun, isn't it? The scientists now are beginning to explore what's happening above our stratosphere. So up into the ionosphere of the Earth, there are things happening that up to now we have thought were impossible. So we're back to the rocks from space thing. For example, we now know that what airline pilots have been reporting for decades is actually true. And scientists laughed at them. So airline pilots were coming back and saying, hey, I saw lightning actually flashing while we were on the flight, and it was flashing out into space, not down to the ground. And the scientists said, no, that can't happen. Sorry, that doesn't happen. But actually it does. Upward lightning is a fact, a scientific fact, and we've now shown on several occasions that it exists. They've seen it from the space shuttle and from the International Space Station. And things like blue sprites and charged clouds or charged masses are similar sorts of things. They are electromagnetic phenomena which occur in the very upper atmosphere and can look like, well, in theory, like UFOs, i.e. small pinpricks of light moving fast and doing certain things. But nobody's yet actually proved that any UFO sighting was one of those.
And finally, sort of jumping ahead on this list, the skeptics list, to explain away why UFOs aren't real, or some of the natural phenomena that can explain them, number 20 is Einstein. Explain.
It's probably one of the strongest arguments. It's used by a lot of people. If UFOs are real, and if they are visiting the Earth for whatever nefarious purposes they might be doing so, then these people say, you know, that can't happen. It just cannot happen because, A, they must be fairly advanced, which means they're coming from civilizations that are a lot older than us, which means that they must be further out in the galaxy and the universe than we are. Now, if that's true, they say, how did they get here? Because nothing, according to Einstein, nothing can exceed the speed of light. And if they're coming at light speed, then it would take thousands, hundreds of years to get here. And why bother? If it's going to take that long, you need a giant ship with a full civilization on board. So the Einstein argument is that the UFOs don't exist basically because they couldn't possibly get here. That's possibly true. I mean, you know, nobody can gainsay that at the moment. But the other argument, of course, is this Star Trek argument, which is warp drive and wormholes and various other ways of getting around light speed.
Right. But it also presupposes that UFOs are of extraterrestrial origin. It doesn't argue against the fact that there are objects in the sky of unknown origin. So I want to circle back to the photographic evidence. And you've compiled a list of photographs that you think are worth checking out. What was sort of your criteria in putting this list together?
Well, I looked at a lot of photographs, and the criterion was, or the main criteria were, that they had to be plausible, first of all, in terms of what they were trying to show. They had to be taken by people of some credibility, in one way or another, either because they had corroborative evidence surrounding them or because of the history of the sighting. Now, on the one end of the scale, there are the people who take a photograph and immediately go to a newspaper and say, I've got a photograph of a UFO. How much will you give me for it? And, you know, depending on which day of the week it is and whether the newspaper's desperate, they might or might not pay for that particular photograph. But at the other end of the scale, there are people who take photographs and genuinely do not do anything with them or don't understand what they've seen and really don't want to make money out of it. They regard it as a curiosity and something that actually belongs to everybody. Now, all the six examples that I've got in the book are such visuals. Some of them are photographs of what we would consider UFOs in the old days, you know, circular objects in the sky. Some of them are lights in the sky, for instance, the Tremonton film, and some of them are very compelling. You know, the lady in Canada, Hannah McRoberts, who took a photograph on Victoria Island.
One of the photos that's on the list is the 1942 Los Angeles UFO raid. But as you point out, that photograph has been retouched. So why does that get on the list?
Well, actually, it's not on the list. It's mentioned in the book, but it's not in Chapter 7. There are only six in Chapter 7, and I've deliberately left the Los Angeles one out because it was retouched apparently retouched. But having said that, of course, there are quite a few people still alive who remember what happened in Los Angeles and who say, yes, there was something quite weird going on because it couldn't have been Japanese bombers. And suddenly everybody got very excited and started firing shells. But more people were injured by falling debris from the shells than were injured by the actual UFOs, if they were UFOs.
As technological advances in photography and videography increase at an incredible pace, there's going to come a point, if we haven't already, and I suspect we've already reached it and surpassed it, where we can no longer sort of accept photographic or video evidence for UFOs. What are your thoughts on that? Is there kind of a cutoff date as far as you're concerned?
There is no cutoff date on any evidence. It's like saying that because a photograph can be retouched or photoshopped, it can be it's got to be ignored, because we accept photographs from crime scenes, we accept photographs from witnesses who see natural disasters and crimes, traffic accidents and so on. We accept all that, but the police will always look at the evidence and say, could that have been retouched? Could it have been manipulated between the taking and the giving it to us? And yes, it could. So you're absolutely right, Richard. We are living in an age where everything can be done on a video or a photograph that we want it to be done. We can paste in anything, and it generally doesn't look particularly false. But the expert can see, and they know when a photograph is right or wrong. So what I'm saying is, if there is enough reason, enough credibility for the witness themselves to be believed. So, there was a lad in a place called Exmouth, which is down in Devon in the UK, a couple of years ago, who saw a triangular object in the sky with three lights, and he took a video on his iPhone. It wasn't a particularly good video, but one of the things that was good about it was that it had context in it. He had trees in it, which allowed you to see the movement of the object and the way that it was shaped. So that meant that particular photograph was quite compelling. It was one that everybody sat up and took notice of, and the scientists, well, such as they are at the moment, the ufologists, are saying, yeah, it's pretty genuine. So I wouldn't discount anything modern, but the problem for the scientists and for anybody really studying UFOs is there's just so much of it. Whereas back in the 40s and 50s, you may get, three or four photographs a year.
We're coming up on the top of the hour break. I do want to talk about the Mariana film from 1950, an old film, but still, as you point out, extremely compelling. And I want to also get your take on the Billy Meier photographs. Would you be good for that when we come back?
Yeah, absolutely. No problem.
Terrific. And the other thing that we'll do is we'll open up the phone lines at the top of the next hour. We'll do an hour of phone-in for James Abbott, The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. And, of course, then we'll also walk through some of the... I mean, there's too many here to mention. There are 40, in fact, the most compelling sort of UFO cases. And we'll talk about Rendlesham, of course, which is on the list, and as many as we can get to. James T. Abbott, Volume 1, Mystery and Science of The Outsider's Guide to UFOs. That's encouraging. That means there's going to be a Volume 2 and a Volume 3. Here's Keb Mo taking us into the break with America the Beautiful on Coast to Coast AM.